sure to grab some sources. David, there's some sources in the back. Thank you for coming. All right, so last week what we did is this kind of an introduction along with chapter 1 of the Megillah. It's wonderful to see so many people. Thank you, all of you, for coming. David, Glynis, thank you very much. Sources are on the back. So we did some introduction, and we read the first chapter. Just very, very, very briefly, because, again, if you weren't here and you want to try and learn the first chapter, there is a recording of that class online on yutorah.org. All right, I sent the link also in the email. If you want to learn the chapter in Iyun more into depth, that's a good thing to do. But again, if you weren't here last week and you only joined for chapter 2, chapter 3, it's still good. Don't worry. We haven't met not Mordechai, not Esther yet, not Haman. There is a lot to say, and that will be in this class. So last week what we saw is we spoke about the historical background of the Megillah. Yes, Joel. Oh, I hope no one brought Ra'ashan, please, with the Yiddish, come on, no more Yiddish, we're Hebrew, Ra'ashan, right, the word Ra'ashan, think about it for a moment, Ra'ashan comes from the word Ra'ash, which is noise, right, just a noiser, makes noise, right, Ra'ashan, so Gregor, I don't know, Ra'ashan, yeah, we'll let you do it once, all right, Joel, once, so we will not interrupt the flow of the class. So last week we saw the historical background of the Megillah, of the Book of Esther. We spoke about Ahasuerus. Who was he in terms of historical facts, right? Who was he? Which king was he? What exactly was his the situation in his kingdom? And so on. We spoke a lot about the situation of the Jews. What exactly happened? How did Jews come to ancient Persian kingdom? What exactly happened? I gave this handout, this bookmark, Esther Timeline. If you haven't received one because you were not here last week, let me know. I have some copies with me. I will give you at the end of the class and so on. And we also said that the Book of Esther is actually the last book of Tanakh. How come? Because it's the latest in terms of the timeline, in terms of when exactly did the story happen, took place, all right? Very, very late. After, there was already a temple in Yerushalayim. The second temple was built. The Jews could go and make Aliyah and live in Eretz Israel, but they decided to stay in the Gola, in the exile, and be close to the king and everything. So that was last week, and we also spoke a little bit about Vashti and what happened with her, and so on. Today, we're going to start chapter 2 and chapter 3. We're going to jump right ahead into the text. We're going to start reading. I'll read in English. All right, so make sure you follow, and I'll stop here and there to add some sources over here. I will thank Steve for the book of Esther and Yosef. I brought something from there here, so thank you for that. It was very, very useful. All right, so starting with chapter number 2. After Vashti was, she was divorced from Ahasuerus or killed, depends how we understand it. All right, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed upon her. Now, what's going on here? Just as an historical fact, all right? So between the first chapter and the second chapter, we have a gap of 4 years. We know that. Historically, we have a gap of 4 years between what happened in the first chapter of the Megillah and the second chapter of the Megillah, all right? In those 4 years, Ahasuerus went on what we spoke last week, which are the battles. All right, Ahasuerus, as the king of the Persian kingdom, had those battles that he wanted to fight in order to expand his kingdom. He fought mostly the Greeks, the Hellenists, which we will know later on from Hanukkah. All right, we have a common enemy. And he fought them in the area of Greece, and he needed a lot of political support from all his ministers in those 127 kingdoms. So what he did was inviting all of them to the feast that he had, in order to gain their political support. That is the background of the feast of the first chapter. However, in those 4 years, when Ahasuerus, which again we assume is Xerxes, King Xerxes, all right, when he fought those battles, he lost. He lost every and each of those battles in those 4 years. And those battles were, when he came back home to Persia, then he wasn't so likable like he was before. We know that from Persian recordings, all right, that he wasn't as likable as he was before, and he wasn't as popular as he was. Not only that, also the financial crisis that happened that was there in those times in the Persian Empire was really, really, really hard. And keep that at the back of your mind. We'll get back to that when we talk about the financial situation of those in the Persian kingdom. All right, remember that. So the background of Ahasuerus after 4 years, suddenly remembering of his wife Vashti that he decided to send out from the palace and to divorce, makes more sense that we understand that he comes back home and he has actually no support from the public, and he doesn't really have any wife to just return when he comes back from all the battles. All right? So this loneliness, or this almost desperate that we see of Ahasuerus, comes from also political background. It's very important to understand that. All right? So now it makes sense why he thinks that he needs also a wife. All right, the resources on the back. Thank you for coming. All right, the king's attendants. Those who served him said, let them seek for the king young, beautiful virgin woman. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, and they will gather every young, beautiful virgin woman to Shushan, the castle, or the capital. Again, depends how we understand that. To the house of the women, to the charge of Hege. That was his name. He was the king's eunuch, all right? Keeper of the women. Now, it makes sense that a man will be the keeper of the women if he is a eunuch, all right? And their ointments shall be given to them. And the young woman who pleases the king shall be the queen instead of Vashti. The matter pleased the king, and he did so. Now, I want to ask you a question. We all know this story. What do we think? Do we think that the authors of the Megillah, and again, I'm reminding you, last week we asked, who wrote the Megillah? The answer that the Gemara is giving us is the Great Assembly. Thank you, Debbie. Exactly. The Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the Great Assembly. All right? They wrote the Megillah years and generations after the events took place. In other words, we should not look for historical accuracy in the Megillah. That's not a history book. We want to learn about history. We'll open Persian recordings. We want records. We want to see what's going on in the Megillah. We'll learn the Megillah. So it's not exactly, I would say, or necessarily accurate in terms of history facts. But we also know that those writers who wrote the Megillah, they had the entire Tanakh in their hands. They could read the entire Tanakh. And I want to ask, when you read those verses, do you think that the Megillah is in favor of what Ahasuerus is doing, or actually opposes this idea of having this reality show of bringing all the women from all around the kingdom to audition to become the new queen of Ahasuerus? What do you think? Are we in favor of that, or do we oppose it? Take a look on the verses. There are 3, 2, 3, and 4. What do we think? It's the opposite of tznua. It's not too modest, all right? But they're not Jews, so maybe we'll say it's fine. Now, again, I want to thank Steve Morris for lending me the book. It was a beautiful book that compares the story of the Megillah to the story of Yosef. All right, very interesting. And I brought, and there I found actually the answer to what I think, whether we are opposing this thing or not. And I brought you a table in your sources over here, not on the text, in the sources. There's a table on the first page. And in that table, there is a comparison, beautiful comparison, between the story that we read now about the Ahasuerus looking for a new wife and Yosef in the palace of Paro. Just as a reminder, what happened with Yosef? Yosef was appointed by Paro to be in charge of the entire financial system of the Egyptian kingdom, because he told them, interpreted a dream, that there will be 7 years of famine, and then there will follow 7 years, sorry, there will be 7 years of prosperity, and then 7 years of famine. So he told Yosef, go and do this and this and this, store all the food that you have, so we will have enough food later on. So take a look at the verses. It's amazing how the writers, the authors of the Megillah, had this story in mind. It's just obvious. For example, in Ahasuerus, in our story, we just said, "Vayafked hamelech pekidim bechol medinot machuto." Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom. "Vayafked hamelech pekidim," "Vayafked pekidim," appoint officers. There is only twice in the entire Tanakh that we find this verse, this phrase. Only twice in our Megillah. And when did the second thing? In the story of Yosef. Take a look. Let Paro do this. Let him appoint officers for the kingdom. Same phrase. Only here and there. We have no other instance in the Tanakh. Second idea. And they will gather the young, beautiful virgin woman. In terms of Yosef, it says, they will gather all the food from this coming good years. Vayikbetzu. Look at the Hebrew. Vayikbetzu. Again, it's special words that appear only there and only here. Alright? Eliyad Hegesris HaMelech. Under the hand of Hege, the king's eunuch. And in Paro it says, under the hand of Paro. Food in the cities and guard it. Under the hand is not something we have a lot in Tanakh. And last thing, which is really obvious, Vayita Vadavar Beinei HaMelech. The matter pleased the king. Vayita Vadavar Beinei Paro. And the matter pleased Paro. In those three verses, we use the same words as we use in those three verses of the story of Yosef. If that doesn't tell us that the authors of the Megillah knew already the story of Yosef and wanted to allude to this story, they sent us to the story. But why? What can we learn from that? So one can say, what can we learn from that? We should learn that just like Yosef was very smart in terms of gathering, collecting all the food, maybe we'll say that those servants of the king were very smart in their idea to bring all the women and to gather them and keep them in, store them in the king's palace. But I don't think so. I don't think so. I think what they wanted, the authors of the Megillah, by sending us intensely to the story of Yosef, what they wanted us is to compare between what Yosef did and what they did. While they collected and stored food, they collected and stored women. All right? Think about that in that sense. What Yosef did was very smart. Very, very smart. He took care of the food. He had this very good idea. But in the kingdom of Chashverosh, we see how things are being handled, how things are managed. And in that sense, food is women, and we store the women just like we store food in the times of Paro. That's my understanding of the comparison. In other words, the Megillah, the authors, are against this idea. They don't like it. And I also tell you, there is a Midrash. I didn't bring it in. In Chazal, our sages tell us that some of those servants were Jews. Those advisors who advised the Chashverosh, go and bring audition all the women, they were Jews. And they wanted to do so for one reason. They wanted a Jewish queen. They wanted a Jewish queen, says the Midrash. They said, look, we live outside of Israel. It will be very good for us if we have a Jewish queen. Right? It's like people count how many Jews are in parliament, how many Jews are in office, how many Jews are in, wherever they are, right? So like, why? We want as many Jews as possible, because possibly we assume if there's a Jew in office, he will be very good for us. So it's not, well, we can debate that if that's true or not. But we see that also there, says the Midrash. All right, so it's very, very interesting. Now we're introduced to our main character. Take a look in verse 5. We should all read together, right? Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBirah, a Judean man or a Jewish man was in Shushan the castle, and his name was Mordechai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, Yemini, all right? Who had been exiled, verse 6, who had been exiled from Jerusalem with the exiles, that had been exiled with Yehoniah, king of Yehuda, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylonia, had exiled. Verse 7, he raised Hadassah, who is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother, and the young woman was sharp, was shapely and beautiful, and with the death of her father and her mother, Mordechai took her to him as a daughter. So there's a lot to talk about in this introduction. First and foremost, the reader stopped following what's going on in the palace, right? The author tells us, hold a moment. We close, right? The scene is closed. We move to a different scene. Now the spotlight is on Mordechai and Esther, an introduction to them. So we should ask ourselves, what do we learn from this introduction? So take a look. The first thing that I want to talk about is the word Yehudi. Who else was called Yehudi in the Torah, in the Tanakh? Who else is called Jewish?
Yehuda.
No, Yehuda is not Yehuda, Yehudi. We don't have it. Who else? You're right, no one. No one. No one in Tanakh, except of Mordechai, is called Jewish. Mordechai is the first Jew. Ivrim, they were Hebrews. They were Hebrews, they were not Jews. What is the word Jew? The word Jew, as they translated here, which is right, is Judean, comes from the tribe of Yehuda. But Mordechai did not come from the tribe of Yehuda. From what tribe did he come? Benjamin. He's Ishimini, Benjamite, right? So why is he called Yehudi? Why is he called from Judea? We should ask ourselves. Like, we read it all the time. Not only that we read it, like, we say it out loud while laying the Megillah, right? We all say it together. But, like, we should ask ourselves, why is he called Yehudi if he's not Yehudi? He's not for the tribe of Yehuda. The first answer I'll give you for that, and the only answer, is that the term of Yehudi, Jewish, started to be something only then. When the exile, the Jews in the diaspora were settled where they were, and they knew there is already Jews in Israel, and that's fine. But they were there, settled, as part of the kingdom, assimilated where they were. Being Yehudi was the nickname to all those who came originally from the kingdom of Yehuda. Doesn't matter from what tribe you come. You came from the kingdom of Yehuda. Now you live with us, so you are Yehudi. This is one of the adjectives to tell us that, you know what? They live, Mordechai is part of, he's not living in Israel. If he would live in Eretz Israel, he would not be called Yehudi. He would be called Yemini. But Jewish is only when you're outside of Israel, when you're already settled outside of Eretz Israel. Yeah.
But wasn't politically at that time there was a split. There was the land of Judah, and then there was the 10 tribes. So isn't it the 10 tribes that were exiled?
That way earlier. Way earlier. Okay. Also those of Yehuda were already exiled because Yechoniah was the king of Yehuda.
Okay.
All right, they were also exiled, and now they all come back, except of 2.5 tribes, which we believe Ethiopian Jews and so on. Yeah, Ira and then Joel.
The timeline, how many years ago, is it 3,000 that there became Jews from Hebrews? Because I always thought people were Hebrew until Moses came down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, and then that created...
So now you have the answer. The answer is people turned to be Jewish when? When they went out of Israel as part of the exile at the time of the first temple.
With 3,000 years?
Something like that. Yeah, you have the timeline from last time, right? Yeah, it's around -586. That's when it happened, so yeah. It's 2,500 years. Yeah, almost 3,000 years. Yeah, Joel.
I was going to say, don't we also know that Benjamin also, generally speaking, lived within the territory of Yehuda during the...
But you don't call anyone Yehudi if he's not from the tribe of Yehuda.
Right, but I'm saying, but in terms of like... It's
he lived in a kingdom called Yehuda, you're right,
like,
he lived.
I live in North York, okay?
You're not a North Yorker, right?
But I'm also from a citizen of Toronto. Okay, fine, but we're in the seed, right?
The difference is that North York and Toronto are not names of tribes. Maybe
but
they were, I don't know.
Speaking,
but they're not anymore, all right? It's only the name of the neighborhood. Yehuda is the tribe. That means that's your ichus. That's where you come from.
The point was, didn't Benjamin kind of live amongst Yehuda the same way how like Levim and Kohanim have the same territory?
No, because Yehuda is the entire kingdom, and anyone who came from Yehuda, even though he's not Binyamin, he's called from now on Yehudi. That's why he's called Yehudi. I'll just continue, and then we'll have some more time for questions, because I do want to finish the chapter. All right? The second thing that I want to focus on is Mordechai's name, or in other words, Mordechai's ichus. Take a look. Mordechai, the son of Shimi, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite. Why is it important for us to know his father, his grandfather, and his grandfather's name? Do we know that for Abraham? Do we know that for Moshe? Do we know that for David? Why is it so important to know four generations backwards the name of Mordechai? I'll give you my answer for that. And my answer may not be as easy to hear, and I'm sorry if I'm ruining some of the childhood understanding of the Megillah in that sense. But take a look. Let's first of all understand the name of Mordechai. What is Mordechai? Where does Mordechai come from? Take a look in source number 2. We have a source. Navi Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah tells us in 52, Higidu Bagoyim, declare among the nations, source number 2, declare among the nations and proclaim, rise and standard, proclaim, hide nothing, say Babylon is captured, Baal is shamed, Merodach is dismayed, her idols are shamed, her fetishes dismayed. Merodach, or in Hebrew, Marduch, was one of the Babylonians' idols. Marduk is a Babylonian god. That's Avodah Zarah. Now, if we take a look on Mordechai's father's name, for example, take a look. The word Yair, the name Yair, in source number 3, we go to Bamidbar, very Jewish. Yair, the son of Menashe, went and took its towns and called them Chavot Yair. Yair, we already know the name, as the son of Menashe. He's a grandson of Yaakov. All right? So take a look more. Sorry, he's a grandson of Yaakov. Take a look. In source number 4, the name Shim'i, the father of Yair, says as follows from Sefer Shmot, actually from our Parsha, all right? The sons of Gershon, Livni, and Shimi. according to their families. The word Shimi, the name Shimi, already dates all the way back to Sefer Shemot, to our Parsha. And the name Kish, grandfather, great-great-grandfather of Mordechai, the name Kish comes from Sefer Shmuel. Shaul, King Saul, is the son of Kish in source number 5. Take a look. In source number 5, it tells us, now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish. He's also a Benjaminite, by the way. What do we understand from that? Why did the author decided to mention all the names of those generations? My answer to you is that we can compare. And we should compare Mordechai's name to his ancestor's name, to his father, and his grandfather, great-grandfather. They're all Jewish names. And then comes this Mordechai with this very non-Jewish name, and he lives in Shushan. What is it if not assimilation? What is it if not assimilation? Think about it like someone, again, for us, Mordechai sounds like a Jewish name today, right? Mordechai is Jewish. But back then, it's not Jewish. Think about it, compare it to, I don't know, Christopher, the son of Shmuel, son of Yosef, son of Yehuda. It's the same thing. When we read Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish, we should understand Christopher, son of Shmuel, son of Yosef, son of Yehuda. That's supposed to be the same thing for our ears. Unfortunately, throughout the generations, we lost it. And we thought Mordechai turned to be a very Jewish name. But he tells us that Mordechai assimilated into this population, into the Persian culture. He assimilated, and I'll tell you more than that. Mordechai also was one of those who came back. We told you, if you remember, we said that second temple was already built in Eretz Israel. If they wanted, they would just go and make Aliyah and live in Israel. And actually, Mordechai tried. And Mordechai tried to make Aliyah. How do I know that? From Sefer Ezra, the book of Ezra, source number 6. Mordechai appears in source number 6. We can jump. I'm not going to read it inside. But we, among all the names of those who made Aliyah, the first Aliyah, wave of Aliyah, in the times of Shivat Zion, the returning to Zion, as we call it, one of them is Mordechai. You see, it's highlighted. Mordechai was one of them, and we know it's the historical Mordechai. Mordechai tried to make Aliyah. He was already there in Israel, and he came back. Mordechai came back to Shushan. Why did he come back? We'll try to see. But Mordechai is someone that tried to make Aliyah and decided to go back to the diaspora and live his life in Shushan. Now there's a midrash that says Mordechai tried to go once and then he couldn't. He come back once again. But this is all midrashim. Pshat-wise, as I like to say, Mordechai assimilated into this world. And not only Mordechai, because take a look on Esther. What is the meaning of the name Esther? Do you know that? The meaning of the word Esther in that sense has different meanings. One of the meanings of the word Esther, first of all, we know she has two names, right? Her first name is Hadassah. Right? That's her Hebrew name. And her general name is Esther. First of all, why does she have two names? Why does she have two names? Now we know that when Jews want to have also this general identity, which is not only Jewish, they have dual names, right? They have an English name and a Hebrew name. It's very common also today. Very, very common. First of all, we know that her parents, maybe they wanted her also to be part of the outside world. But one of the facts is that the book is called the Book of Esther. It's not called the Book of Hadassah. And she's not called Hadassah throughout the book, not even once, only here. She's only called Esther. She identified herself as Esther, not as Hadassah. That was her first name. Hadassah was her Hebrew name when she received an Aliyah, if she used to go to a shul where a woman received Aliyah. All right? But her name, her official name was Esther. That's who she was. And take a look, what is the word Esther? Where did it come from? I'll give you three answers. One answer is there is a goddess, another idol, the Babylonian idol called Ashtar. Ashtar is a Babylonian idol, the idol of love and fertility. Her name is Ashtar. Esther and Ashtar are the same. There was one of the goddesses. Another answer can be the word Stara. Stara means a star. Star. The word star that we have in English from Latin also comes from Persian. And Astara, star, was the name of Venice. There was one of the stars that the Persians used to worship. So her name is also just like Mordechai's name. That's a Persian name. It's an Avodah Zarah name. She also assimilated into the world. But she's different than Mordechai because she doesn't have parents. She doesn't have parents. And if Mordechai is the son of the son of the son of the son, Esther is no one. We don't know who her parents is. Think about the comparison. Compare between Mordechai and Esther. What ichus does he have, and what no ichus does she have? Let's continue reading. Let's continue reading from the Megillah.
But we can assume she's from Benjamin.
Esther?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Her uncle?
Avichayil. Her father is Avichayil. We'll see that. We know her father's name. who's probably Mordechai's brother, and then the Meshi might be from Binyamin. Again, I'm not going to get into that, but there's different opinions whether Mordechai married her, or was he just adopting her, was he her uncle, her cousin. There's a lot of explanation, but I'm not going to get into that now. All right? Verse 8, when the king's word and his law were heard, and when many young women were gathered to Shushan the castle, to the charge of Haggai, Esther was taken to the king's house, to the charge of Haggai, keeper of the women. She was taken. Now sometimes we think, oh, Mordechai told Esther, go. Maybe you should go, right? You should go. I'm registering you to the audition. They would love you. You'd be amazing. You'll take first place. No, but with the Megillah tells us Esther was taken. And all the verbs are passive verbs. They're not active verbs. Take a look at the verbs that I read. Verse 9, the young woman pleased him and won his grace. He hurried to provide her ointment and her portions and the seven maidens whom she was entitled to be given to her from the house of the king. And he favored her and her maidens in the house of the women. Verse 10, very important verse. Esther did not tell her people or her family, for Mordechai commanded her not to tell. We know that Esther, she hid her Jewish identity. Now, when I grew up and in kindergarten, I remember that, what I remember, like what Rashi says. Rashi says, why did she hid her identity? Because Mordechai told her, if you're going to tell your Jewish, we'll kill you. This kind of anti-Semitism, all right? Don't tell you're Jewish. You're not going to be elected, according to other parshanuyot, other commentators. But based on what we just saw, the fact that Mordechai tells Esther, don't tell your Hadassah, just call yourself Esther, maybe that's not coming from any kind of ideology. They're just assimilating. He tells her, like, why do you need to be so Jewish? Don't be so Jewish. You want to be the queen. We need a Jewish queen. Just go and be there. And we see, I'm not going to read it inside, I brought in the sources, you can see it later. There are commentators who read this in a critical perspective. They color it in dark colors. They tell to Mordechai, what are you doing? Where do we find in halacha any permission for a Jew woman to marry a Gentile king? And to hide her Jewish identity so much? Like, what about Shabbos? What about Kashrut? What about Mikvah? What about all of those? We threw everything to the garbage because you want a Jewish queen? Again, I'm reading it in a negative light because I think this is what the author of the Megillah wants us to do. That Mordechai and Esther, what they did was wrong. What they did was not so successful and not so good according to the authors of the Megillah.
Unless you treat her like a Meraglim, like as one of the spies.
Unless you treat her as one of the spies and so on, but why would you want a spy? What happened so far? Nothing happened. There's no decree. There's no Haman. There's nothing. But let's get to Haman. Just, oh, that was your... That was the only one. Verse 11. And every day, Mordechai would walk before the courtyard of the woman's house to know how Esther fared and what was to be done to her. Where is Mordechai? He's in the palace. Where is he? He can speak to Esther. And that's not the only time. Throughout the book, Mordechai and Esther can still schmooze with each other. How come? Folks, Mordechai was not a simple person. He was not one of the people that lived in his house in the suburbs while his wife was the queen in the capital. That's not the case. Mordechai himself was a minister in Ahasuerus' palace. He was a very important figure in the castle, in the palace. There's no other way to understand also why he came back from Israel. He had this job opportunity, I would say, and that sounds very harsh, but he had this job opportunity. Oh, you are very smart. You're a very important person in the Jewish world because he was part of the Aliyah of Ezra and so on. You can come and be appointed as one of the secretaries, as one of the ministers in the palace. And Mordechai lived in the palace. And now it should not be so strange for us that also Esther won. No, we always think about it. Like, Esther won. Why? Why did Esther won?
Beautiful.
She was always beautiful. Okay, that might be true in that sense. But she was also under the responsibility of Mordechai, who was very close to the king. What do you think? There was no corruption back then? Of course there was corruption. If you read between the lines, what the authors are telling us is as the story is very different than the regular story we read or we think we know of the Megillah. That's not only on this chapter. It's throughout the Megillah. And I will try to prove it. All right? So that's another thing. Another thing that I want you to see As I ask you, why did Esther win this competition? Why was she appointed as the queen? All right. If we take a look on how Mordechai sees it, on the introduction, I'm returning to verse 7. It says that Esther, it says the young woman was shapely and beautiful. Right? That's how it described when we introduce Esther as part of Mordechai's family. She's introduced as shapely and beautiful. But when we introduce Esther to Ahasuerus, and we see why Ahasuerus fell in love with her, the words are different. It's not shapely and beautiful. It's different. And I'm jumping to verse 15. And in verse 15 it says, and Esther won favor in his eyes. V'tisachen v'chesed lefanav. That's what we say in Hebrew. Chen v'chesed are not beauty. Maybe chen is, depending on how we read the commentators. But chesed for sure is not beauty. That's her character. That's her who she is. That's her teva, her nature. That's her skill. She's a very good woman. So while we're introduced to Esther as a beautiful, shapely lady, when we talk about in Mordechai's home, when it comes to Ahasuerus' home, we understand really who she is. So think about it again in terms of criticism against Mordechai. Then maybe he was part of it because she's also beautiful. She was lovely. All right, I'm continuing reading. In verse number 12, and when each young woman's turn came to the king Ahasuerus, after she had been according to the law of 12 months, for so were completed the days of their anointing, 6 months in oil of myrrh, and 6 months in perfumes and women's ointments. Doesn't matter now why and what exactly is going on here. It's related to the Persian tradition of how exactly you appoint a queen, all right, in different ideas. Also, in Chazal, we see some of them echoes Avodah Zarah, in that sense, that this process was not only to beautify herself, it was also involving Avodah Zarah idolatry, in that sense, a lot of perfumes and so on. Jews don't really use perfumes in Tanakh. Usually when we see good smells, in that sense, if it's not for the Ketoret, which was the incense in Beit HaMikdash, it's related to Avodah Zarah, all right, in many, many, many things. We know also until today that like we don't really have like perfumes in shul and so on, but other nations, other religions do use smell as part of their worship in different ideas, all right? We only have the incense, and that only for God, it's not for us. So it's interesting to think about that. Maybe there is idolatry in that sense, all right? In verse 13, so would the young woman come to the king? All that she said would be given her to take was her from the woman's house to the house of the king. They used to walk back and forth from their house to his house every night and so on. All right. In the evening she would come, and in the morning she would return to the second woman's house to the charge of Shadgez, the king's eunuch, keeper of the concubines. She would not come again to the king unless the king desired her. And she was called by name. Who else? Totally, totally different comparison. So don't get me wrong. Who else was called, could come to the king only by calling his name? Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu could come to Oel Moed when HaKadosh Baruch Hu called him. He told him, come to Oel Moed. I said, Vayidaber Hashem Moshe Lemor. All right? Think on that comparison. In that sense, between Moshe being called to the King of Kings and Esther being called by her name to the King of ancient Persian kingdom. There's a lot of references in the story, all right? Verse 15, and when the turn of Esther, daughter of Avichael, now we know her father's name, Avichael, again, Avichael is a very Jewish name. Avichael, that's Jewish, that's Hebrew. And her name is Esther, Ashtar, Astarika, there's different goddesses that she named after, the uncle of Mordechai, whom he had taken to him as daughter, came to come to the king, and I read it in a negative tone. I don't read it in a lovely, beautiful tone. I read it like, Esther, the daughter of Avichael, what happened to you? You're the daughter of Avichael. How come now your name is Esther, not Hadassah, and you're going and you're sleeping with this Gentile king? You're the daughter of Avichael. But what happened? Mordechai had taken her as a daughter. That's the way I read this verse. Mordechai taken her as a daughter. That's what happened. Came to come to the king. She did not request anything except which Hegai, the king's eunuch, keeper of the woman, said. And Esther won favor in the eyes of all who saw her. Esther, verse 16, was taken to King Ahasuerus, to his royal house, in the 10th month, which is the month of Tevet. in the seventh year of his reign. That's where we know we have a word, the month of Tevet. That's not a Hebrew word that we also celebrate. Comes from here. Tevet is a Persian word. All right, almost all the Jewish month coming from Persian months. All right, in that sense, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won favor and grace before him. See, favor and grace. Chen v'chesed lefanav. It's not only the beauty, it's her favor, her grace before him, more than all the virgins. And he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. That's one of the proofs against Chazal, those opinions who say she was married to Mordechai. Because if she would have been married to Mordechai, she would never be taken to the palace. They only look for virgin women. All right? So according to the opinions in Chazal that she was married to Mordechai, it's a little bit difficult with the pshat. All right? The king made a great feast, obviously, right, for all his officers and servants, the feast of Esther, and he made a release for all the provinces and gave gifts in accord with the king's power. When the virgins were gathered a second time, wait, what's going on? Behikabetz betulot sheni, that's what we say in Hebrew. Why is there a second time? Well, like, when we read the Megillah and Shul, like, we don't really pay attention to that, right? Like, okay, there's a second time. Why is there a second time? I thought, like, we all think it's all happy, they lived happily ever after. Why is there a second time? So when the virgins were gathered a second time, Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate. And this opens the, from here I would say, even though it's not the same chapter as chapter 3, chapter 3 really begins in that verse. Why in that verse? Because this is the introduction to the rise of Haman. All right? Also the fact that there is again another cycle of recruiting women. Why is that? I would say, I saw one answer. I didn't see a lot of answers for that. Rabbi Dr. Benjamin Lau from Israel said as followed, and I think it's pretty obvious. We should read this second cycle as a reason for the rise of Haman, because Haman was the one who suspected that there is a problem with Esther, because maybe Esther is Jewish. How could he know that Esther is Jewish? Because everyone knew that Mordechai and Esther are related, and then there is something that's going on between Haman and Mordechai. We'll see, we'll read it. That Mordechai did not bend to Haman because he was Jewish. So Haman said, wait, if he did not bend because he's Jewish, what about this queen? Maybe there is a problem with the queen. And he, the one that convinced Ahasuerus to have another recruit, because maybe there is a problem with that queen. We were not told so much. It's not from the pshat. We don't understand it. But that was, for me, at least when I read it in Rabbi Dr. Benny Lau, it made much sense when I read it. 1 second, Debbie. 1 second, all right? I want to finish the chapter. And this is a famous story, how the chapter ends. Esther would not tell her family and her people as Mordechai had commanded her. That's why we're told about it again. So we understand that someone suspected it, not because she told it, all right? And Esther did Mordechai's biddings as she had when she was raised with him. In those days, we're told, while Mordechai was sitting at the king's gate, he is very close to the table. He's a minister. He sits at the king's gate. Bigtan and Teresh, two eunuchs of the king, who guarded the door, grew angry and sought to send forth their hand against King Ahasuerus. Now we understand also why. Remember, I told you that he was not so popular after what happened in the war. We should ask ourselves, what happened that Bigtan and Teresh want suddenly to kill their king? But they want a revolution because King Ahasuerus was not so popular after what happened. This war, this great war, which we're not told in the Megillah, and we should, I think, complete the gap. All right? The matter became known to Mordechai. How? Because Mordechai was part of the ministers. He knew what's going on. And he told Queen Esther. Again, they can talk to each other. He has this unlimited access to the queen. It's not something that can be so, it should not be taken for granted. Mordechai was very strong in the palace. And Esther told the king in Mordechai's name. The matter was investigated and found to be so. And both of them were hanged on a post. And it was written in the book of Chronicles before the king. We know that this book will appear later on in the sixth chapter of Esther. That's how the second chapter ends. I'll take one question. Debbie, you had a question? Yeah. And then we'll continue to chapter 3. Yeah.
How Esther felt about Ahasuerus? Is there any indication?
Like nothing.
Nothing.
Did she bow down to us?
We'll talk about bowing down in a minute. I don't know about Ahasuerus. I assume she did. I assume she did because she has. When we'll see, carry on, when she goes to speak with Ahasuerus and she's not entering until he tells her, give her permission and so on. We'll talk about it in a moment. All right, let's start chapter 3. Let's read chapter 3. Now we're introduced to, that's one of the shortest chapters in the Megillah, but it's actually one of the longest when we lay in it because the name of Haman appears so many times. in this chapter, and it takes, I don't know, it takes forever to finish this chapter, all right, when we read it. So take a look. We should be happy. There's no kids around to make any noise. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedata, the Agagite, and exalted him, placing his seat above all the officers who were with him. First and foremost, what is after these things? Says Rabbi Dr. Ben Hillel, after what happened, the idea that Mordechai saw what happened with Bigtan Vateresh, Mordechai was not promoted, Haman was promoted instead. Again, they were colleagues. Haman and Mordechai were colleagues in the palace. We should understand that they were both ministers in the same government. All right? Mordechai, we would assume, should be promoted after what happened, but he's not. We should be surprised, and Haman is promoted. And then that's a good introduction or background to understand why are they so hating each other. There's also something political and personal behind the relationship of Haman and Mordechai. When we were going to ask ourselves, why did Mordechai bow in front of Haman? One of the answers is personal. Because they are political rivals. That's one of the answers, all right? So who is Haman? What is the meaning of the name Haman? There is some answers for that, all right? What is the meaning of the name of Haman? Here. All right, so Haman, there's different ideas. Most of the researchers believe that Haman comes from two different words, Hama, Mana. Hama, Mana in ancient Persian means the person that has an opinion. All right? The person that has an opinion. It's very interesting. It's not an idol. It's not a Persian idol. It's a person that has an opinion. Interesting to think about in the context of the Megillah. I don't really understand why, but I think it's interesting. He is the son of Hammedata. Hammedata, data is, if you were last week, law, right? That. Hammedata is the law. He is the person that has an opinion, and he is the son of the law. All right, there is meaningful, the names are meaningful behind it. There's a lot to be said here. All right? He is Agagite. What is Agagite? What is Agagite? Agag. Who's Agag?
Shaul killed him.
Exactly. Shaul didn't kill him. And Shmuel killed him. Shmuel killed him at the end. Veishasef Shmuel et Agag. That's my haftarah for my bar mitzvah. I remember that. In Sefer Shmuel. So we see that Agag is the king of Amalek. All right? And Haman, we're already being told, he is Zera Amalek. Now think about the difference. Mordechai, we were told, Mordechai and his father and his grandfather and so on. Haman, we're not really seeing anyone except his father. We go all the way to his number one forefather, which is Agag. All right? We skip so many generations all the way back. It's important for us to understand, to compare between the two ideas. Mordechai, it's important to know who he is, who his father, because what we said. Haman, we don't care. We just care where he comes from. He comes from Agag. That's what really matters. We know only by his name that he will be a trouble to Jews. Even we know what happened, really. Even before what happened, that's why we're told about that, all right? And we should know that he's now above all the ministers, also above Mordechai, even though Mordechai was the one to actually deserve this promotion. All right, let's continue reading. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate would bow and bend to Haman, for so the king had commanded regarding him, but Mordechai would not bow or bend. Why didn't Mordechai bow or bend? One of the answers is, as I said, personal political rival. All right? And I will tell you more than that. How do I know it's actually a stable answer? Because within our commentators, and I didn't bring it inside, within our commentators among them, we find commentators who actually criticize the decision of Mordechai not to bow in front of Haman. We know there is no problem of bowing in front of a king or a minister. According to Halakha, we see it in many times. With Paro, with Yaakov, with Esav, and so on. There is bowing in front of human beings. But according to those who believe there is something personal behind it, those commentators come to Mordechai and say, Mordechai, what are you doing? If you're not, because of you, because your personal ego, because you are a rival, a political rival with a man, you're putting all of us at risk. Because of you not bowing to Haman, the entire Jewish people is now at risk. What are you doing? Again, there is critical reading of the Megillah. And that happens almost in any verse, as you see it, right? One second, Martin. I want to continue. Another understanding, which I personally prefer, I'll be honest, comes from the Ibn Ezra. I'll read it outside. Ibn Ezra said, why didn't Mordechai bow in front of Haman? Because it was considered to be to worship idols, all right? Avodah Zarah. That's what the Ibn Ezra said. Now you should ask yourself, why? Why there Avodah Zarah? So the Midrash said he had those necklaces of Avodah Zarah on him and so on. I want to bring a proof from the sentence, from the verse. And if you take a look on the Hebrew one, in verse Bet, it says, Kol'im u'mishtachavim lehaman. The verbs that the author uses is Kol'im u'mishtachavim. Now, it doesn't appear a lot in Tanakh, this, I would say, this two words of Kol'im u'mishtachavim. We use it in Aleinu l'shabeach. I see that he's looking right now, Michael. Aleinu l'shabeach said, Va'anachnu Kol'im u'mishtachavim u'modim, right? Where does that come from? That comes from the idea that, take a look, for example, in source number 15, I brought only one, all right, there's some, both of them. When we find those two words together, they're always in the context of religious worship. All the time. Take a look in source number 15 from Tehillim. Bow nishtachave v'nichra'a nevarcha lifnei Hashem osenu. Let us bow down and bend. All right? Nishtachave v'nichra'a. Kol'im u'mishtachavim. Those two words together are always coming from a religious perspective. We should assume that when the Ibn Ezra says that Mordechai did not bow in front of Haman because of religious reasons, he reads those words, Kol'im u'mishtachavim lehaman, is a religious kind of act. It's not a political act. It's not to honor or to respect him. People are worshiping Haman because who he is, and they are Kor'im u'mishtachavim to him, so Mordechai is not doing it. I think it's a fabulous reading that the Ibn Ezra reads exactly the words and brings it in a broader context of what exactly Kor'im u'mishtachavim is. All right? Let's continue. Verse 3. The king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordechai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Again, he is part of other ministers. All these fellow colleagues tell him, why don't you do that? And in verse 4, when they said this to him day after day, and he did not listen to them, they told Haman to see whether Mordechai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Judean, that he was Jewish. Folks, you understand what's going on here? Haman did not notice that Mordechai is not bowing for him. And those colleagues, Mordechai colleagues, are the one to go to Haman and to tell him, oh, Haman, you should take a look. There is a minister. He's Jewish. He's not bowing in front of you. He's not respecting you. Those people are the one that really caused the trouble here. And we don't understand that in that sense. All right? But this is where I said that Mordechai reveals himself as Yehudi. That's why we say it's Mordechai HaYehudi. All right? It's Mordechai the Jew. He's a Jew. And he told them, I'm not doing it because I'm Jewish. By telling them that, they knew also and started suspecting that he has his relationship with Esther, maybe she's not 100% perfect like we think she is. And that's the reason, says Rabbi Ben Elau, that they had this second cycle of recruiting because of this scene. That they could connect all the dots together to say that Esther, maybe she's also Jewish, all right? But again, it's not pshat. Verse 5. Haman saw that Mordechai would not kneel or bow to him, and Haman was filled with wrath. Again, someone is filled with wrath, right? But he viewed it as scorn to send forth his hand against Mordechai alone, for they had told him Mordechai's people. So Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordechai. Now let's pause here for a moment, and I want to ask why. Why? Why didn't Haman just wanted to kill Mordechai himself? Why did he scorn this idea to kill only Mordechai? Why did he want to kill all the Jews? My answer to this, I haven't seen it really supported in any of the classic commentators. That's my understanding, my humble opinion. It might be totally nonsense, so don't echo that everywhere as the only true answer. All right, but I think, and as I will tell you as I read it, that Haman is thinking from a financial perspective. He's thinking about money. And what do I mean? If you remember, we said, after the war, the battle, where Ahasuerus and the entire Persian kingdom lost, they started this very, very hard financial crisis in the kingdom. Very, very hard. And again, he wasn't so popular and so on. Haman, he's second in command. Second in command, we know it, also from Yosef and so on. Second in command is, he was promoted to that, is the one who's in charge on the budget. Ahasuerus told Haman, you're promoted, please help me fill up the gap that I have. I'm lacking money. You're now in charge of the public budget. Please make sure that everything is all right. Right? That's what Ahasuerus tells Haman. That's why Haman is second in command. Now, if you take a look on how Haman is actually convincing Achashverosh, and we'll read it right now, pay attention to the financial aspect of those words. All right, take a look. Let's continue. And then I will explain the word score. Verse 7. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Achashverosh, he cast the poor, which is a lottery. All right, poor, that's why it's called Purim. Right, poor is a lottery. The Chag is called Purim. All right, before Haman, from day to day, and from this month to the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. And then we understand that he will execute the Jews on the month of Adar. Verse 8, Haman said to King Achashverosh, and pay attention to that, there is one people scattered and divided among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. And their laws are different from every nation, and they do not keep the king's laws. It is not worthwhile for the king to live them. If it pleases the king, let it be written to annihilate them. And I will weigh out 10,000 talents of silver to the workmen to bring to the king's treasury. First of all, there is an explicit bribery that's going on here, where Haman is telling Achashverosh, do as I want, I will take care of the money. And now we need to understand, I didn't bring it inside, it's a huge amount of money. It's almost twice of the Persian kingdom budget in those days, according to most researchers. Those 10,000 silver is a huge money, it's a huge amount of money. And when Achashverosh hears it, obviously what he thinks is only about the lack of money that he has in the budget, and he understands he needs money. And where will Haman get all this money from? From the Jews. So why did Haman want to kill all the Jews and not only Mordechai? He said, oh, that's a wonderful opportunity to just kill the Jews and take their money. And I will have so much money because the Jews, if you remember, we said the Jews who stayed in the kingdom are the wealthiest, the most educated, the richest Jews stayed in the kingdom. All the rest went back to Israel. So we have all those Jews here and they have a lot of money. So why should I kill only Mordechai? I have here two birds in one hand, right? I will kill all the Jews. I will take their spoil. I will take all their money. I will bring it to the king. And then I will be the best person in town. That's how I read Haman's reason why he wants to kill all the Jews. And I want to give you another proof for that. And that's the word scorned. The word scorned in Hebrew is vayivez. All right? And it says vayavez Haman. Now the word vayavez appears in other places in Tanakh. Where? Esav, thank you very much. When Esav sells his birthright to Yaakov, all right? It says, Vayivez Esav et ha-Bechora. I brought it here in source number 16. Vayivez Esav et ha-Bechora. Esav scorned the birthright. Why did he scorn the birthright? What is the word Vayivez, scorn? Ibn Ezra says, verse 17, source 17, Esav also scorned the birthright because he saw that his father had no wealth. Scorn comes from a financial background. When someone is scorning something in Tanakh, it's because of financial reasons.
But he said that
Yitzchak didn't have all the money. According to the Ibn, we should talk about it. But Esav said, why do I need to be the firstborn? It's not like I'm going to inherit so much money and from my father. So the Torah uses the word scorn in two places, there and here. And the word scorn obviously is related to money and financial things. So why did it use the word scorn here to tell us, again, that's my offer to you, that it uses the word scorn to tell us that Haman really thought financially behind the entire thing. And he said, I want the Jews' money. I don't want the Jews. It's a classic financial anti-Semitism, right? Classic. And more than that, I'll tell you another proof from the verses. When it says they're scattered and divided, why did it matter that they're scattered and divided? In the Persian Empire, if you were scattered and divided, it was very difficult to collect the taxes from you. Very, very difficult. And how do I know that? Because it says, and they do not keep the king's laws. What does it mean they do not keep the king's laws? It says, I didn't bring it over here, but it says one of the commentators point out, the king's laws are taxes. And when he tells them they do not keep the king's laws, he says, they're scattered all around. We can't collect taxes from them. You just appointed me to be the second in command and the minister of finance. I don't know what to do with these people. He doesn't even mention their name because it doesn't matter. He sees numbers in front of his eyes. He doesn't see Jews. He sees numbers and dollars. That's what he sees in front of his eyes. And when he goes to Achashverosh, who is in the lowest point he could ever be in terms of his popularity, comes Haman and says, don't worry, I'll take care of it. Just let me do whatever I need to do. I'll bring you all this money. Obviously, Achashverosh will say yes. Obviously, he would say yes. So there is a lot of financial reasoning behind the entire Megillah in that sense, and we don't pay attention. But again, I told you, it's my reading. I didn't see it anywhere else. What?
From
Who? Haman was very much. Achashverosh. Thank you very much. He wanted the Jews' money. No, so he's not a great, he's not a pious person. He's not a tzaddik gadol, right? Another thing, another proof that I want to give you is from the word sorer. All right, take a look. In verse 10, the king removed his ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hamadeta, the Agagite. And now we add one adjective which we didn't add before. Sorer ha-Yehudim. The enemy of the Yehudim. The word sorer. What is the word sorer? The first time we see it here in the Tanakh. We also call another person Tzorer HaYehudim in history, and this is Hitler, Yimach Shmo. We also call him Tzorer HaYehudim. There's two, Haman and Hitler in that sense, Yimach Shmo. But what is Tzorer? The word Tzorer in Hebrew comes from one background. And I brought it over here. Tzorer comes, take a look, for example, in Iyov, in source 18. Tzorer means he binds up water. It's only twice, here and there. The word Tzorer now means an enemy. But in original Hebrew, it means binding. Another example is the word a binding of money. It's tzor kesef. That's what the Gemara says. Tzorer means binding, collecting stuff. Why is Haman tzorer HaYehudim? Because he collected the things from the Jews. He collected all the money. He gathered them all together and just took all the spoiled, all their money. Tzorer comes from a financial background and it turns to be the word enemy because of this financial background. Again, that's how I read it. And let's finish and let's read. Let's finish. We have four more minutes. Let's continue. The king said to Haman, verse 11, the silver is given to you, right? It's all financial. And the nation, take their silver. And the nation do with it as you see fit. Verse 12, the king's scribes were called in the first month on the 13th day, and it was written according to all that Haman had commanded the king's satraps, the governors of each province, and the officers of each people, each province according to its writing, and each people according to its language. It was written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's ring. Verse 13, letters were sent out by the runners, Haratzim, to all the provinces of the king to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, Lashmid, Larogu, Leabed, all right, all the Jews, from young to old, Mitav Vazaken, little ones and women, right? Tav Venashim, in one day, Beyom Echad, in one day, in the 13th of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, Ush, in the Hebrew man, the Hebrew letter, the Hebrew word say, Ush Lalam Laboz. And to plunder their spoils. That was really what it's all about. Plundering their spoils. He needed the money. Verse 14, a copy of the text was to be given as law in each province was revealed to all the peoples that they should be prepared for that day. Verse 15, the runners left, pressed by the king's word, and the law was given in Shushan the castle. The king and Haman set to drink, but the city of Shushan was in turmoil. Now, what does it mean was in turmoil? What exactly is going on? Here's the word in Hebrew. We finish it again with Eicha melody. All right. What is Nevocha? What is the word Nevoch?
Confused.
Right? In Hebrew, we say Nevoch means embarrassed, confused in a sense, right? Or turmoil, which is very, very close to that, just more fancy. But we have another place where someone is called Nevoch. And where is that? I'm doing this. This quiz here. Where do we have Nevochim? Nevochim hem ba'aretz, sagar aleihem ha-midbar. Exactly. When Am Yisrael, thank you Martin, when Am Yisrael flees Egypt, it tells us that they were Nevochim hem ba'aretz, sagar aleihem ha-midbar. Paro tells that the people, they have nowhere to go. They are Nevochim ba'aretz. They are stuck in Egypt, in the land. The word Nevoch comes from the word stuck, which means that the people have nowhere to go. When we say that the people were Nevochim, it means that the people of Shushan literally had nowhere to go. They closed the borders. Even those Jews who thought they can escape back to Eretz Israel, sorry, Jews can't go anywhere. You had their opportunity to escape. You had your opportunity to go to Israel. You missed it. Now you are Nevochim Ba'aretz. You are stuck. You're confused out of being in this situation where you're blocked. You're stuck in one place. And this is the introduction and will lead us to what exactly will Esther do when Mordechai hears that. And we'll do it Bezrat Hashem next week. We'll learn chapter 4 and chapter 5. Thank you very, very much, everyone, for listening, for coming. Beautiful attendance. I'm here for questions and comments if anyone wants to come over.